I'm sure you know by now that I have a new book out. It's called Buddhism for the Unbelievably Busy, and I'm very excited to say I'm finally living the dream that I set out in that book. I'm working less as of a couple of days ago, so I've got more time to work on things I love, like this podcast. Anyway, the book is available now at my website, michellelaurie.com. Let's get on with the show. Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence, and it's not appropriate for children.
He goes into a lawyer's office and says that he was there when Michelle was murdered. Mm-hmm. He knows who killed Michelle. And he makes the sound of a knife going into someone's body.
16-year-old Michelle Buckingham was murdered in Shepparton in Victoria in 1983. Despite many in the community believing they knew who'd killed her, her case remained unsolved for 33 years until a young reporter started digging around looking for an interesting story.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Tammy Mills is the inquisitive reporter in question. She's currently a crime reporter for Melbourne newspaper The Age, but she made a name for herself on a much smaller paper when she started a chain reaction that solved a cold case.
I was a cub reporter when I first became aware of the case. So I was in my first job in journalism at the Shepparton News. So Shep, for the listeners out there that haven't heard of good old Shepparton, is actually where I'm from. So it's a little country town, or rather a regional, big regional country town in northern Victoria. And the Shepparton News, was my first gig. So I was writing about all sorts of different things like button collections and sport and fates and big checks, and it was a great start in journalism. So you're doing everything. So amongst all of that fun stuff, I was also doing a bit of crime reporting.
And is there much crime in Shep?
There is significantly a lot of crime in Shepparton.
Really?
It's quite an interesting town. It's the weirdest crime stories would happen there. Like, there was a guy. Not that this is necessary. Actually, it is. I'll take that back. It is a crime. This guy got stuck in a washing machine once, completely naked.
Uh-huh.
And he'd been playing hide and seek with his partner. So
Naturally
you jump into the washing machine.
Is that a crime?
It would have been a crime for my eyes if I hadn't had to see that.
Yeah. It's not great.
It's a crime to my imagination. Right
now. Yeah, okay. So the only way they could get him out was to baste him in olive oil.
I think I remember reading that story.
It was a massive story. Yeah. It went like global, and this guy was doing interviews and whatnot. So it's sort of like weird stuff like that. There'd be just every now and again, there'd be a run of strange sort of crime stories in Shep. So I was sort of getting into crime reporting and started reading true crime books as well, and then started wondering how many unsolved murders we had in Shepparton. So I came up with a list of six that I could find, and there was all sorts of different ones. So there's ones that were mafia-related and ones that were pretty well-publicised over the years. But in that list was the murder of a 16-year-old girl. The thing that really got me about that one is I'd never heard about it before. It was never the ones that we were all talking about growing up. So it's like out of the blue, there's this case in front of me of a 16-year-old girl that was stabbed 19 times and dumped on the side of the road.
And fairly recently, what year did this happen?
1983.
Wow. Okay. What year were you born?
3 years after that.
Oh, okay. Wow.
But it was, again, like nothing that I'd ever remember people talking about, or I never read about it. And then there's this, I think that was what really got me, the fact that I felt like it had been forgotten by some people in the community, obviously not by her family and friends, but
and potentially the perpetrator was still in the community.
Absolutely.
I would think. So this was unsolved when you discovered it.
Yeah, it was unsolved. And I thought that perhaps I could write this story, 24-year-old me, write this story and like maybe bring some attention to it and remind people that this crime had happened. So that was the original goal that I had. And then it turned into something completely unimaginable, and I still can't quite believe what then happens.
How did you start? So you got the idea, you take it to your editor. Who did you go and speak to first?
So the person that actually told me about this case was a photographer that had been working at the paper for decades, and he was actually at the paper when this murder happened. And he said, I will never forget this. Be great if you could do something about this. So then conversations in the newsroom with my editor, with some of the senior journos that were there saying like, can I look into this? Can we do something? And of course they said yes to that because it's a cracker of a story. Mm. And then then it took, I think, at least 6 months, probably the better part of a year from that first conversation to the first story coming out. So in between that time, I was doing still my day-to-day job, but also between stories, just researching and then trying to talk to as many people as possible.
Were her family interested in talking to you immediately, or were they suspicious?
That's what took the longest time was trying to gain their trust. Because they'd, you know, almost 30 years had passed. They gave up hope such a long time ago. So who was I, like this young woman coming to them and forcing them to go through all of this again? So after trying initially and then to talk to Michelle's mother, who was actually still living in the same house that Michelle and her sister and brother grew up in. And I couldn't get to the point of trying to explain to her what I wanted to do and who I was and why I was interested. So I decided I'd write her a letter. So I wrote her like a handwritten letter and just said, my name is this, I'm a journalist here. The reason why I think that I'd like to write something is because I feel like she's been forgotten. This terrible injustice has happened to her and to you and to your family, to her friends. And people need to know this happened still. Like, I realize that you haven't forgotten. I can't imagine what you've been through. But this has faded away from the public's mind. So
it's pretty emotional stuff. Even just listening to you say it now, it's pretty moving.
And good grassroots, you know, journalism, write a letter. It doesn't all have to be, you know, fast and furious.
Yeah,
now,
yeah, you know, yeah. You don't have to contact someone over Facebook.
Yeah, but you've done the lot. What I love about this is, you know, you're passionate, you're doing it in your own time and you're truly taking the steps. It's a very delicate situation when you try to do these stories, isn't it?
Absolutely, because you don't want to re-traumatise people. You don't demand or expect people to want to talk to you because you're a journalist. Just sometimes stories just get you, and this one did, and for whatever reason, well, there's plenty of reasons, this just didn't leave my mind, and I felt like that there was just something that was driving me going, I need to keep trying. So then that's what led to this letter being sent. And then Elvie has given me a call. So Elvira Buckingham, that's Michelle's mum, called me out of the blue one day, and it was like this massive breakthrough because I've been trying for months and months to get her to talk to me, and she said, come around and have a cup of tea.
Oh.
So it was in a really beautiful moment.
What did you find when you got there? I found a photograph here of Elvie holding a photo of Michelle and also holding a doll. You know, was it a situation where Michelle's bedroom was still there and all of that?
Yeah. Wow. Yep. Michelle's bedroom was still there and her presence was still so clearly there. So Elvie had a painting up of Michelle up in the lounge room. There were photos. Like, it just, the presence was really there still. Mm. And that first meeting was just us really having a cup of tea and talking. So she was really interested in like my life and what my family was like and all that sort of thing. So it was not necessarily me sitting there taking notes and asking her questions about everything she's been through. So at the end of this conversation, I remember she's taken my hand and just said, yeah, I give you my blessing. You need to give a bit of yourself sometimes for people to see that and to see that you're not, because there is so much distrust of journalists, rightly, wrongly, different situations, I guess. But you need to give a bit of yourself so then people know that you're invested, that you're in it for the long haul, and you're not there just to do a quick story to get you like one, you know, front page or something.
Yeah, or get some clicks online.
Absolutely. Or, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What was known about Michelle's case?
So
already.
What was known about Michelle's case was they knew she'd been stabbed 19 times. They knew that she'd been dumped on the side of a country road out of Shepparton, so in long grass.
How did this happen? Where was she? Where was she meant to be? Where was...
So she, it was 2 weeks before her body was found. So she went missing for a period of time.
Right.
So Michelle's 16. She's just left school. She's got a dream job working at a cafe in Coles. So she was really seeking her independence at that time and wanting to make money, wanting to move out of home, much to Elvira's displeasure. So that actually caused a little bit of a fight between them in the lead up to her death. So Michelle was staying with a friend, and Elvie thought that she was staying with her dad. So her mum and dad were separated at this time. And then her dad thought that she was staying with her mum. So it's just this awful scenario where everyone thinks that they know where she is, but no one's really seen her. Like, you could walk at any time of night basically back then, and it was fine. And we're talking not about like a city, we're talking about a country town. So,
and she was 16, and in those days, I mean, I was born in 1973, so I was well and truly alive when this happened.
Yep.
And in those days, girls were still leaving school at 15, 16, moving getting jobs, moving out of home. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yep. Yep.
So getting married even when they were 18, 19, 20. So.
Yep, yep. And kids soon after that. Yeah. So it was.
Yeah, I don't think it's unreasonable for your parents not to know exactly where you were.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But so the poor things. So they've realised eventually she's not at your place, she's not at my place, where the hell is she? Is that the scenario?
Yeah. So then Alvie goes to the police station and reports her daughter missing. And then police pretty soon realise that it's not a teenage runaway. Something really suspicious is going on. So they've put out like a big media thing saying, find missing girl. Have you seen her? She was last seen walking down one of Shepparton's main streets. So she'd called in sick to work and gone to meet some friends at the pub at the Vic Hotel. And then she's walked down one of the main streets to go to the caravan park where she was staying. So she's passed a couple of friends on the way, and they remember having a conversation with her about, you know, make sure you just walk under the lights on the way home. And they remember her wearing a Mickey Mouse jumper and some jeans, and she's not seen alive again. So then 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks passes, and a farmer spots her body on the side of the road. So, I mean, what a shock for him. And he's actually, when I was writing the story, he was still alive, living in a retirement home, and it's something that he's never forgotten about either. So she was still wearing the same clothes that she was last seen in, so the Mickey Mouse jumper and the jeans.
Mm-hmm.
And
so he knew immediately who it was? He was aware of the story and...
I'm not quite sure, I'm not quite sure. So then that's... opened up a murder investigation. Yeah.
And so did they have any suspects immediately?
So they had a suspect in mind. This is where it gets really weird. So there was a man by the name of Gregory Gledhill. He had the nickname Punchy because he used to get beaten up basically every weekend. He was not a very intelligent man. And there was lots of rumours at the time that he was trying to get into the local bikie gang. So he goes into a lawyer's office and says that he was there when Michelle was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
He knows who killed Michelle. and he makes the sound of a knife going into someone's body.
Wow.
And the lawyer's office that he went into, who still works in Shepparton, he's a bit of like a local legend. He's been a criminal lawyer for years and years. He never forgot that sound. Like, he was like, you could only know that sound if you'd heard something it, like that before.
As you're talking, I don't know what that sound would be. I can't imagine what that sound is.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So he's given the lawyer a knife and then they've gone to police. So police reckon they've got like a red hot suspect here, right? I mean, like, who's going to come in and make up a story like that and know the sound of a knife going into a body and, like, you know, he's got to be the guy. Like, he's making it up. Not these people did it. This guy did it. So they charged him, and it only got to the very early stages of a court case because the magistrate's basically gone, there is not enough evidence here, threw it out.
Okay. Yeah. But enough evidence to exonerate him or just
not enough evidence to convict him, yeah.
So he was – I think I recall reading from your stories at the time, there was always this cloud over him from then, wasn't there, in the town. He became a bit of a pariah or an outcast.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's when the beatings really increased for him.
I can imagine most people in the town just assumed it was him and he'd gotten away with it somehow.
Yes, absolutely. And even to that – to this – not to this day, but when I was looking into the case at the time, the detective who charged him still believed that he'd done it. He still believed that he was involved.
So that's where it sort of ended for a long time, was it? That they – everyone in town thought, we know who did it, but he's got off.
Yep.
So we'll just take our own justice out on him for the rest of his life.
Yep.
And it's a cold case until you come along.
Yep, until pesky me comes along and starts harassing a detective by the name of Ron Idles.
All roads lead to Ron Idles. Yes. Ron, by this stage, what year are we talking here?
So we're talking 2012.
So Ron is in the cold case, heading up cold case at this stage. And so we know from previous episodes that Ron was the person who suggested we need a cold case unit. He went to the States and studied how they do it, and he came back and started this unit here in Melbourne.
Yep.
So you went to him.
So I went to him. So I remember reading a story about him in The Age, which is where I work now, about how this amazing detective has opened up this cold case unit and they're going to solve these crimes and whatnot. And I was like, oh, that's the guy I need to ring. Because before that, I was getting stonewalled. Like, yeah, I'm a country reporter. There's tons of inquiries every day from reporters who want to get like an exclusive on something. So I was just getting batted away left, right, and center. And so I rang Ron. He was like, who are you? What are you doing? We don't have any resources. But there was like something about him, as you'll know, and your listeners would know if they've listened to that episode. There's just something about him and his passion is pretty obvious. So I was like, I reckon I can talk this guy around. I'll just keep ringing him because like, I'm so far into this that I'm going to write a story, but it'd be great if I can get them on board as well. So I just sent him some emails and kept calling him, and basically he rang me one day. So it's sort of like the same phone call I get from Elvie that floors me is the same phone call I get from Ron. He goes, oh, I'm coming up to Shepparton tomorrow. So what? Okay. Why? I'm coming to Shepparton tomorrow to meet you. I want to hear what you've got and I want to have a sit down with you. And I was just like,
okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah. So he's not just passing through town. He's coming up to see you about this case.
Yes. Yeah, correct.
Wow.
Yeah. So he comes into the Shepparton News office and I show him into a room and he sits down and he's like, we're going to reopen it.
Wow.
Yeah. He goes, this case is solvable. I'll never forget him saying that. He looked across the desk from me and just said, this case is solvable. We think there's people in the community that know what happened.
Yep.
And we're going to give it a crack.
Wow. So who got to tell Elvie? Was it Michelle's mum? Was it you or Ron?
Ron.
Yep. Ron phoned her.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I think Ron actually went around and saw her.
What a day for her.
Yeah.
After the break, the extraordinary circumstances that unfolded when the case was reopened. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Tammy tells us exactly what happened to Michelle Buckingham on the night of her death. But first, word of the case reopening spread very quickly.
Ron says, well, we're reopening it. I said, can you give me like a week or so just to write a whole bunch of stories for The Shepherd and You? So we'd planned out a series of stories over the course of the week just to keep just smacking people with this, what had happened, what had happened, do you know something, come forward. And the first day of that series was a front page photo of Michelle.
Yeah.
It's a black and white photo of her wearing a stripy jumper, and the headline is Who Killed Michelle?
Very striking front page.
Yeah, it was very, very well done. So, again, had a great team at that paper and was so really well supported by everyone in that newsroom because, again, like it's a newspaper 6 days a week. There's not a lot of staff, so
yeah,
was very, very fortunate.
But they got really got behind you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They wanted that story as much as I did. So the first day, Who Killed Michelle? And the right person read that story, that first story. So we then go to a news agent's in Kyabram. There's a guy that's wrapping the newspapers for the day, and he unfurls a copy of that front page and almost has a heart attack because this guy knows who killed her.
Oh,
so how is that? Like the guy that's wrapping the newspaper is the one that knows. So
and he's lived with that for 30 years.
Yeah.
So he contacts you or rings the number that's provided or whatever?
No. So he contacts his brother-in-law who he also disclosed that he knows something about this too. The brother-in-law then contacts Ron and Ron then contacts him. And then Ron and this guy have a meeting. And Ron called me after that meeting. So that's within the first week of that those stories.
Wow.
And Ron says, I've solved it.
I've solved it.
Is that the quickest solving of a cold case ever, do you think?
I know, probably.
Why didn't this guy, I'm sure we'll get to this, why didn't he ever bother, why did his conscience suddenly get the better of him because of that front page?
I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why people don't come forward.
Mm.
So for this gentleman, Norm Gribble, he was worried about losing his family. So his connection to one of the killers is he is this guy's brother-in-law.
Okay. But not the same brother-in-law that he
The brother-in-law that he contacts is the killer's older brother. There were three killers, and one of those was Stephen Bradley. And Stephen Bradley is Norm's brother-in-law. So the morning after Michelle's murdered, Stephen goes to Norm. They were really close at the time, and he said, we killed a girl last night. I killed a girl last night. And he's got blood on his hands. So Norm's like, well, who knows what was going through Norm's mind at that stage, but Norm takes Stephen to have a couple of beers so they can talk about it, and Norm says he's encouraged him to go to police. Stephen doesn't want to, he's freaking out. Stephen's like 21 at that stage, and Stephen decides he's going to leave town. And Norm doesn't say anything to anyone for years and years because he's worried that if he dobs in on his brother-in-law, he'll lose his wife, Stephen's sister, and he'll lose his family. And so it's something that he feels is the most important thing to him.
Does Norm know the other two perpetrators?
Yes, yep. Yep, he knows the other two men. The court heard that those two other men that Stephen says was with him and...
Have they not been charged?
No. There's not enough evidence. Oh. We don't have someone like a Norm that has come forward to say... this person told me that they did it, or there's no evidence as well to link them to the scene either, except for Stephen saying so. It's just not enough. It's not enough.
Was Norm scared of these men? Is that as well some of the reason he never came forward?
Norm always said it was his fear of losing his family. So I cover courts a fair bit and other murders since them and some other cold cases as well. And there's different motivations for people keeping secrets. And family is one of those reasons, fear of their life.
Mm.
And then the reasons for people coming forward is that things change. So relationships change. So Norm's relationship with Stephen had soured, and there was the court had heard at the time that there was a bit of a fracture through the family. So the circumstances had changed.
Ah.
Yeah.
So Ron believes at this stage that he has, you know, solid, believable evidence that this Stephen Bradley is at least one of the perpetrators. Where is Stephen Bradley living at this stage?
So Stephen is living in Brisbane.
Ah.
He's working as a dog groomer.
Mm.
And another, the other person that was with him that night was also living in Brisbane. It's a bit weird.
Yeah.
Don't know if they've been talking. Not sure.
You wonder if they'd maintain their connections.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess Ron tracks him down. Does Stephen Bradley confess?
Stephen Bradley does not confess. So he's arrested two times. So the first time he doesn't say anything and the second time he doesn't say anything. But then there's a subsequent three interviews that police do with him. So Ron Ittles does a couple of those. And then in the final interview with another police officer, Simon Hunt, Stephen changes his story. So it goes from, I don't know who you're talking about, to, I remember her, but I had nothing to do with it, to then admitting that he helped dispose of her body. Wow. And the other really, like, interesting thing that he says is that he has been haunted by the ghost of a girl for all these years, a ghost of a girl who comes and sits on his bed, the end of his bed. It's really spooky.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you live with something like that? Yeah. Like,
and why did they pick up, was, what do you know about actually what happened, you know, in light of the solving of this case?
Yep. So what the court had heard is that Michelle, who had actually dated one of those three men, not Stephen, when she was really young, like 13 or 14. So she knew one of them. And when she was walking, you know how I was telling you about how she was walking home and gone past the Star Bowl, which is a bowling alley, and spoke to some friends. So then she keeps walking and they pull over in a car, the three men, and offer her a lift. So she gets into the car. And then what happens is, they try and have sex with her. She says no. They get angry, and for an unimaginable reason, the three of them stab her.
So Bradley's convicted?
Yes. Yeah, so Bradley was convicted of murdering Michelle Buckingham. So there was a trial, and a jury was satisfied that he did it. So he was sentenced to at least 21 years in jail, with a maximum of 27 years. So that happened in the courthouse in Shepparton, very old courthouse in Shepparton, and it happened before a lot of Michelle's family, except for one really important person.
Tell us about that, because it's pretty it's a very sad twist, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like life, you know, like nothing ends tidily or happily, like in a happy, tidy way, right? So 3 weeks before the trial was to start, Alvy passed away.
No.
So it's yeah. So I she's mean, had a heart attack in her home and died. And at the time she was really stressed and really worried and not quite sure of what was going to happen and not really wanting to believe that it could finally come to an end of sorts and finally get some answers. So
Not wanting to believe that it might not. I mean, what was she worried about? Was she worried that they wouldn't get a conviction?
Yeah, she was so worried about that, and she was worried about getting her hopes up again.
Yeah.
So for all this time she's been protecting herself and trying to protect her family from what they went through initially, not only with the murder obviously, but then with the charging of Greg Gledhill and then that going nowhere and him being exonerated. So she just didn't want to put herself through that again.
Yeah.
So she wasn't quite there in terms of wanting to really think that this was possible. And I guess like the only positive to be brought out of any of that is what Michelle's sister Karen and her brother Philip would always say, which is, she's finally with Michelle now. That is where she wanted to be for so long. So she's finally with her.
What can you tell us about Michelle's siblings, actually? I mean, that's a difficult life to live, isn't it, when one of your siblings has been murdered? I guess there's sort of survivor guilt, and there's also your parents' obsession with that lost sibling.
Yeah, and Karen and Philip are just both, like, the whole family are just beautiful and really welcoming, and really welcomed me into their lives, and it was extremely still is extremely special. So Karen, I don't think, talked about it for a really long time. I remember going to Karen's house after the verdict came down, and after the sentence came down, I think, and they had all of their family there. So they've got a huge family. They've got Alvy's brothers and sisters, cousins, like a huge family that are all still living in the area. So they invited me around, and it was just pretty magnificent, like, because I was just like, I'm so sorry. I don't know how I feel about everything because of what's happened with Alvy.
It's a weird situation. You can't really celebrate. What is the feeling?
For me, it was just, I couldn't say that I felt particularly satisfied because of what happened to Alvy, and then thinking about, did the stress of the court case contribute to her death? But then what the family kept saying to me is, like, you gave us answers. Mm. Like, you gave us an answer. You gave us something that we never had. And for that, we are just so grateful.
I was also thinking your story had probably an impact for Greg as well, didn't it?
Yes.
So what happened with Greg?
Oh, my goodness, you're so right. I feel terrible. I forgot about Greg, or a.k.a. Punchy.
Punchy, yeah.
Who the whole community believed for years had murdered Michelle.
Because that kind of wrecked his life. And also I'm wondering, why did he go and confess? I still
don't quite understand the reasons for that. Mm. I met Greg actually in 2012, and I went around to his place. He was living with his dad, who was a taxi driver, and his brother was there as well. And Greg was just like a shell of a human being. That's the only sort of way I can describe it. Like, he could sort of say words here and there, but he couldn't string a sentence together. He was just like, I don't know what that was. I don't know if it was mental illness or if he'd had some sort of brain injury or like what was going on there, but he was a shell.
Mm.
He was a shell. So what then Ron did for him in publicly coming out and saying he didn't do this was enormous.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime, and thank you to Tammy Mills, whose excellent work you can find online. Thank you also, speaking of excellent work, to Sound City Studios in Spotswood for helping us record in beautiful quality. They're not paying me to say that, and we paid for our session. I just want you to know that they're excellent. Okay, we'll see you next week.